You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Good evening, everybody. Jacob Daniel here. This is the Daniel 3 podcast. And thanks for tuning in. I appreciate it. As always, I have to start with my sponsor. We got Rabbit Eye Blueberry Wine, my good friend Will Bell down in Georgia, fellow Mises Caucus member and good friend. You've probably seen me, if you watch Reed Coverdale's show, you've probably seen me and him go back and forth on Reed's show a few times because Reed does a little, if you haven't seen it, you should go watch it. It's we call it the Capitalist Communion, and we have a little like atheist Christian roundtable and have some good conversations over some blueberry wine, and it's all good fun. But I'm not much of a wine drinker, but I like this. So I would definitely recommend it the nice thing is that they have a little bit of like a wide variety. So they have like super sweet wine, and then they have like dry wine and everything in between. So again, that's rabbiteyewine.com. Other than that, the website is back up finally. I switched hosts, and then like some kind of weird error happened, and we had to consult like three different specialists to like figure out what the bug was and to get it fixed. So, but the website's back up, daniel318.com. And if you want to, you know, support the show at all, it's patreon.com/biblicalanarchy. That's pretty much it. I have Jose coming back on the show either tomorrow or next week. We're still trying to get our schedules figured out. But I'm excited to have my guest on tonight. He is the 2020 vice chair candidate of the Libertarian Party. He is the founder of You Are the Power, and he is one of my favorite voices in the libertarian movement, the one and only Spunk Cohen. Spunk, how you doing
Spunk
tonight?
Conan. Spunk Conan.
Spunk Conan, that's right, yeah.
Spunk Conan, yes.
It's an upgrade over Tasha's spouse. So, I mean, we're getting there.
I mean, sure, it's kind of my name, so we're getting there. I did recently, was that this week or last week? I was very briefly, for several million people, I was a guy on Twitter named Spike Cohen. So that was Tucker Carlson shared
right,
something.
Yeah, that was cool.
I don't know what 20 million people who ever watched that. So he did say Spike Cohen, but I was a guy on Twitter named Spike Cohen, which is... It is my name, and I am a guy, and I am on Twitter, so nothing was inaccurate. I feel like we're getting there. It's like baby steps. One day, someone's just going to be like, Spike Cohen, who is his own person in his own right. But we're not there yet, so we're working on it.
One day I'll be enough. You know, self ownership. You know, that's what we're about.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, we'll get it there. Yeah. So I feel like you don't need too much of an introduction, so I don't want to spend too much time on that kind of stuff. You've been on the show before. Okay. I think everyone knows who you are. But we're coming off of, we're 2 weeks removed now, I guess, just about from the Libertarian National Convention at Reno. Yes. That's been talked to death a little bit on various different shows, so I don't want to spend, you know, another hour and a half beating that already dead and pulverized horse. But I don't know, maybe you wanted to review Reno a little bit and also kind of maybe review, although it's not been that long, maybe review, you know, kind of maybe any things you've seen since then. And, you know, if you think that, you know, people are kind of, you know, moving in a positive direction or not. I wasn't able to attend, but I watched live. And so I was able to see everyone's speeches, including yours, which I thought was, you know, a needed voice of reason, which you always try to be. And I appreciate that. But yeah, what did you think of the convention? What was it like? You know, highlights, lowlights, and, you know, what's your kind of, I don't know, thoughts on where we're at, you know, now kind of 2 weeks removed and what the outlook is?
Sure. Yeah, no, I'm happy to beat this, as you put, already dead horse until it's just flush with the surface of the ground that it's on. Like there's no there's no longer a horse. It's basically a horse shape on the asphalt. No. It was a shame that you weren't there. There were some incredible speakers and you would have also gotten herd immunity. Or helped contribute to herd immunity, because I think I got COVID there. Thankfully it was way more mild than when I got it earlier this year. Everyone got COVID, so that was something. I guess that was the low light, if you want to think of it that way. Although we all have great immunity coming into the summer, so maybe that's a highlight. In terms of the convention itself, I suspected that what was going to happen was going to happen. I knew that the Mises caucus would have the largest faction there, but I suspected that they would come in dominant, like, you know, 2/3, 3/4, something like that, because I had been to so many state conventions where that's what they were doing there. And I thought, well, you'd multiply that times 50 and there, you know, you've got the, you've got 50, yeah. You know, 40 plus of the state conventions that were dominated by the Mises caucus, and they were going to come in, and they had, and they also, unlike any of the other, I guess, factions, really at this point, there's Mises versus anti-Mises. They had an agenda, whether you agree with the agenda or not, they had one, and it was very explicit what they were going to do. And they had a game plan for implementing it. And everyone else was just against it. Or actually, there were some people in the middle who weren't.
I was going to
really
say,
sure
like, I feel.
About. I want to say the other formed faction.
Yeah, the other people aren't really a faction. They're just kind of like the people who haven't really picked a side in the quote unquote, you know, culture war within the Libertarian Party. They're just like they, you know, just.
They want to do stuff. They want the
ones who
want
it exactly. Yep. So
and I think what ended up happening was a good number of those people ended up going with Mises once the convention was underway, because they thought, well, that's who's doing it. You know, they have an agenda. Let's try it. You know, they've clearly, you know, here's the thing. Whatever criticism you want to give about Mises, and full disclosure, I've been in the Mises caucus since I think 2 days after it was formed. I'm typically in any group I'm in, I'm probably the oldest member of the Mises caucus, unless Michael is there. I was pretty fairly outspoken in being against the whole idea of the takeover language and the sort of the narrative behind it. I thought it was kind of overly adversarial. I think that I would have preferred more of a messaging of, we have a bold new direction for the party and we invite you to join us, as opposed to these people are bad, they're losers, and we're going to take over. It worked, you know, worked. I never thought it wouldn't necessarily work. I just thought that it was going to create a lot more division than it needed to. Ultimately, they won, right? They came in, they had the best numbers. It wasn't even close. And they completely dominated every single aspect of the convention. The two things I want people that I hope people are walking away from it with are that, number one, no one has died. This is not, you know, there wasn't a purge. People weren't put up against a wall. No one was guillotined or put in a gulag. A faction took over the party. And if they do really well, which I hope they do, because I want this party to grow and I want this movement to grow, then we'll do great. And if they don't, if they utterly fail, well, then we will have learned our lesson and we can move forward from that. And more than likely, there's going to be successes and failures. We can maximize on the successes. We can learn from the failures and we can move forward from there. And if you are still, you know, deeply against this, bring more people. You have to organize. Party politics, both internally and externally, is all about bringing more people to show up than anyone else to have them on your side. That's what it's all about. So bring more people next time. If you are happy about how things are going and you want to make sure that Mises continues to stay in charge, bring more people. So it really, it comes down, you know, I'm distilling it down to its basic thing. Party politics is about bringing more people. The other takeaway I want to get is that, unfortunately, no one wanted to try to compromise at all with Mises and see if there were ways that they could work together for the most part. So for example, it was basically Mises' way or the highway for the entire convention. And that wasn't 100% their fault because no one was really trying to work with them.
Really, until you were the one exception to that.
The one exception to that was with the bigotry wording. I understood why they wanted to remove the bigotry wording. There's nowhere else in the platform that makes a moral judgment about someone's actions or behavior other than saying you shouldn't force anything on anyone else. So like, we don't say the government shouldn't tell you what you can put in your body, but heroin's really bad and it's bad for you and it could ruin your life. We don't say the government has no business telling consenting adults what kind of sexual relationships they can get in, but having lots of unprotected sex can lead to, with, you know, multiple unknown partners, can lead to, you know, STDs and unplanned pregnancy. Like, we don't do that. So this was the one time that we're going, but, you know, this is really bad and we condemn it. The problem is, if you remove it, it looks like we're kind of saying that we're okay with that, right? Like, that's what it looks like, is we're going, actually, we don't really think bigotry is bad. We don't have a problem with bigotry. We're cool with bigotry.
Yeah.
So my compromise, which I kind of came up with, that I had a couple of people reach out to me and say, are you cool with the compromise language? And I said, well, what's the compromise? What's the language? And they said, well, we were hoping you'd do that. And I'm like, all right, cool. So I talked with Angela McArdle. I talked with Michael. I talked with some non-Mises people that wanted to work on it. I talked with some prominent people in the movement, a couple prominent donors and so forth, that were saying that they were going to leave the party if this was just removed. And so I kind of crafted some wording. And what I came up with was, you know, we uphold and defend the rights of every person, regardless of their race, ethnicity, or any other aspect of their identity. And everyone either thought it was an acceptable compromise or better than the wording it was replacing. And so it passed almost unanimously.
I think it's kind of both. You know what I mean? Because I mean, I think that I kind of agree with you that in a maybe like short term, at least, there might be a like short term cost that we have to like just take that bitter pill and swallow it, because some people might look at it just initially and go like, oh, they removed the bigotry plank and
you're cool,
they'll take
bigotry,
uncharitable
right?
Yeah. Look. Yeah. But like, that's, to me, like, that's not going to be a narrative that lasts very long. That might last, you know, a month or two. People might reference it down the road. But anyone who actually looks at the platform and sees what it's been replaced with, you know, I think it is a better plank now with the new language, because rather than just kind of like, you know, ill bigotry, we find that disgusting. Now it's like, no, like, what are we going to do about
what
people
are we
who irrationally collectivize groups of people? It's no matter what group you belong to, no matter what, how you identify, like, you have the same rights as everybody else, and we're going to fight to protect those rights. So I think it's actually an improvement, even if there's a bitter pill to take at the onset.
There was going to be a bitter pill to begin with, and they had the numbers to amend the wording, and they already said that even if they didn't have the numbers to, because it takes 2/3 to do a suspension of the rules to amend the wording, they said if we have to just remove that entire plank, which only takes a simple majority, then we'll do that. So it was going to happen. And the reason I brought it up is that there are times where you can work with a dominant faction and not even come to them with a, hey, you know, this is going to help something pass, you know, that you won't be able to get passed otherwise, but come to them and say, hey, what do you think of this? Maybe this is better. Maybe this is something that can work better and get even more support. And there was zero opposition from Mises or from any of the people that were against it. But up until that point, no one was talking to each other.
Yeah.
And there's nothing magical about that. It's just talk to people, like, literally
right.
Just talk to people.
And like, so like, I'll agree with you that perhaps the takeover rhetoric, like, you know, I mean, it is what it is at this point. It's over and done with. But like, you know, could a better message have been chosen from the onset? Like, it's possible. I mean, I think it's clearly possible because as much as it maybe inspired people in, like, you know, in my camp, so to speak, it also turned off some people who I think are good libertarians and they might feel a little bit disenfranchised.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, but on the flip side, there weren't a lot of people who were approaching us. I won't say none, just not a lot compared to what seemed to be, you know, there weren't many people approaching us in good faith compared to the amount of people who would go, well, you guys are just right wing Trumpist, you know, extremists and bigots. And we demand X, Y, and Z. And if you don't do that, then it's like, we're just going to rage quit or just keep calling you names on the internet. And it's like, well, that's not fertile ground for anything to be done.
It's also not much of a threat, right? Like,
yeah, that too.
It has been interesting to watch people who fancy themselves political strategists and activists saying, if you don't do what we say, we are going to do a series of things that arguably help you. Like, we're going to not present a viable alternative. We're going to not organize to bring more people. We're going to do this kind of like cloak and dagger, you know, shenanigan stuff with the rules to make you look more sympathetic to someone who's kind of on the fence on this whole thing. We're going to give you the moral victories by trying to purge you. We're going to say how upset we're about it constantly, which actually energizes you because that was fine with you for us to be upset. Like, every action we take is going to, if at the least, not hurt you, and at most help you politically. So you better do what we say. And it just it didn't work. I told Michael for the and quite a few people, I've said it on a few shows as well, all last year when people were coming up to me and saying, well, you know, we have to stop the Mises Caucus. I've been upfront with saying, listen, I want all sorts of competition. I want as many different competing groups bringing all sorts of new blood in and having a wide, robust debate marketplace of ideas of how to move this party forward, and then go and all do it our different ways, not even have to just pick one way. So I was telling people, listen, if you want to stop Mises, look at what they're doing. They're making this fun. They are gamifying it. They're making this an immersive experience for the people that are joining their caucus. You need to do that too. And they didn't.
No.
They didn't. So Mises won. Could Mises have done better with, you know, choosing less inflammatory rhetoric regarding, you know, the takeover or whatever? Because I know people that, like, align with the goals and values of Mises, but they didn't like that. They perceived it as an invasion. We're libertarians. We kind of naturally, you know, bristle against a perceived invasion, right? So I think it could have been better, but ultimately it didn't really matter because they were the only ones who had a solid ground game for organizing. And so they did it. Going back real quick to the compromise wording, the analogy I've been using is this. If you are, if you're someone who has people in power who are threatening you and threatening to, you know, oppress you, threatening to marginalize you, threatening to harm you with the power of the state, let's say it's because of your skin color or your ethnicity or your sexual identity, whatever, your gender identity, it doesn't matter. For something that you don't have any control over, because of their bigotry towards you, they're using the power of government to infringe upon you, to make your life harder, and ultimately to harm you. And there are two people witnessing this. And one of them says, I condemn this. It's irrational, and arguably even worse than that, it's repugnant. Okay?
Yeah.
And then another person is standing there and goes, I will do everything I can to advocate for you, to uphold your rights and to defend your rights because this isn't right and no one should be treated this way. Which of those people do you think is going to be a more effective ally against you who are being harmed by actual, not just bigotry, someone's bad opinion about you, but actual like systemic bigotry, actual people in power using their power to hurt you because they hate you? Which one of those is something that's you think is going to be more helpful? Someone condemning the fact that it's happening or someone pledging to actually fight alongside you to fix it?
Yeah, exactly. And the latter actually is, I think, more effective too, just because, like, I was never offended by that plank, but I understood why a lot of you know, fellow people wanted to remove it because we've kind of been on the receiving end of that word being weaponized and really the meaning of that too, word being obfuscated by I think the political left over like the last decade, especially. I remember even like this is part of what, because I used to be, you know, registered Democrat and Bernie Sanders supporter before I became a libertarian, but I never really got into the like full-blown like woke stuff and kind of like wanting to call everything racism because it just seemed silly to me. It was just like it is what it is. I think that's been talked a lot about, but I agree with you. I think that I like the new wording better, and if people don't like it, like I don't know, it's fine. I get why the optics of removing it might look bad initially, but it's like, again, like, you know, now what's happened since then? Have you seen the LMC Twitter go out there and make a bunch of like, you know, tweets about how we hate minorities or something? Like, no, it's, if anything, it was funny because we made a tweet on like, I don't know, within the first couple of days of Pride Month about LGBT rights.
Yeah.
And then
yeah.
we had some people on like, you know, maybe the far right side of the camp going like, oh, you guys are just as woke as the last regime.
You're woke.
And I was like, I did see that. I was like, no, okay, now you're just being silly. I was like, you know,
and what was interesting was there were people saying, oh, you're just as woke. And it's like, no, they're literally saying they defend everyone's rights and that government shouldn't be involved in your relationships. That's a explicitly libertarian message.
Now. I don't know.
That's not. Yeah, that's woke. That's now woke. Acknowledging that there are different people that are in different subgroups that are affected.
Well, somebody literally told me it was the fact that you used the term LGBT. I was like, wait, are we not allowed to acknowledge that gay and trans people exist now?
Exist? Like, but it would be like saying focusing on the fact that, you know, some of these COVID regime restrictions were especially harmful to the parents of young children whose development was, you know, delayed as a result of not, you know, getting the access to education and things like that. And people going, but what about like high school kids and adults too? It affected that. Why are we pandering to children and parents? Like you can acknowledge that there's a specific group or subgroup of people who are acutely or more acutely affected by a specific thing as an example of the overall overarching message of you should have control over yourself and ownership of yourself. It's just, otherwise all we would tweet is you own yourself. No one should tell you what to do. And then the next day you own yourself and no one should tell you what, like you're messaging to what people are talking about. There's nothing wrong with that. But then I saw on the other side that there were people going, see, this is the problem. They don't understand that the problem is not government harming, gender and sexual minorities. It's the bigotry of people that won't accept them. No. The problem is
the violence,
when that is put to power.
Right.
The problem is not someone going, I don't know, the gay people, that just don't sit right with me. The problem is when that person or some other person uses the government to enforce their bigotry. We talk a lot about like systemic racism, systemic bigotry, and the left and really the right too wants you to focus on the racism part or the bigotry part. Libertarians would like you to focus on the systemic part.
Right.
Without the system in place to harm people, regardless of why they're harming them, whether it's because of your race, your ethnicity, or just because you're in their way, which more often than not is why it is, because they're predators and you're prey. But whatever it is, if you get rid of that gun, it doesn't matter what the person who was wielding it thinks about you, because they don't have a gun to use against you anymore. And I hope moving forward, and I've already started seeing it, and I liked it in that LGBT tweet. I liked it in what I've seen so far from the Libertarian Party social media and in coordination with the state affiliates. I'm going to admit I haven't seen every single thing. I've been really busy with You Are the Power, so there may be something that I would look and say, oh, I'm not sure what I thought of that. But overall, everything I've seen has been putting it back to what actually matters. Take the power out of the hands of these craven, pandering politicians and do-nothing bureaucrats and the billionaire cronies that sponsor them, that, and put it back in your hands. That's what matters. That is the core of our message. And if we stick to that, I think it's an inherently intuitive message. It's one that makes sense. It's an inherently populist message. We're literally saying power to the people and actually meaning it. And I think it's a winning message. I think if we stick with it, it's a winning message.
Yeah. And I think some people on both maybe extremes just don't understand that, like, again, criticisms can sometimes be very warranted. I'm not somebody who would say Mises Caucus has always, you know, there have been things that I've been critical about. But I think overall, the way I've looked at it is that, like, the push has been to bring the LP back to a more principled and more thin libertarian approach, not really hyper-focusing on either side of the culture war. Now, because, and this is my opinion, and, you know, some people can feel free to disagree, but I think up until this takeover that the dominant culture and direction the LP was going was, to a certain extent, leaning more towards the quote-unquote left side of the culture war.
I think it's socially libertine, right? Like people that they're not just saying that you have the right to do it. They're saying, and we agree with it and we're cool with it.
Right.
Like we personally like it, which that still has a place in the movement, right? Like that, I consider myself, I live personally very traditionally. You know, I'm a monogamous married man. I don't do drugs. I don't even drink. I don't even drink coffee. I'm almost Mormon. And I'm pretty traditional in that way. But I also am like pretty open and accepting of however anyone is choosing to live, as long as they're not hurting anyone else. I'm not just tolerant, I'm actually accepting. But that's me.
Right.
And that, but I'm also accepting of people who don't think that way, as long as they don't want to harm anyone else. I don't have to agree with your opinions on society. That's the whole point of libertarianism. We need to declare a truce between people who think this way about society and cultural things and people
exactly,
who think this
yeah.
way, as long as we all agree that we should not be forcing ourselves on others, right? And I think the party as a political party should be keeping as much of a skeleton framing around just saying, we support your rights. We support your right to do all of these different things. And we leave it up to individual people, whether they like it or not. And that's really what it is. I really think we should be doing that.
Yeah. And that's what I was trying to get at, is that like there's people on both sides who think that our, you know, our thin libertarianism is too thin, because, you know, some people will conflate it with their more, you know, libertine, you know, socially progressive outlook of libertarianism. Yeah. And then some people, you know, and like I have to deal with this on my side because I'm more of a like conservative Christian. But it's like, so I think we talked about this a little bit last time on your show. It's like, I, you know, I tend to have conservative views of, you know, and religious views of what marriage is. It's between a man and a woman. I don't really have the same views on sex or gender identity that people on the opposite side of the aisle of me would have. But it's like, but I'm not trying to make libertarianism Christianity. I just don't want you to make libertarianism the opposite, you know, either. It's like, let's just agree to, like, let's end, as you said eloquently, let's just end the systemic oppression of you know, all these different
anyone
groups. And then you have freedom of association. And I think that's what, you know, so, and I think, you know, not perfectly, but the Mises Caucus has been attempting to come back to more of that sort of thin libertarianism. But if you're on the left, you're kind of going like, oh, you're moving towards the right. Therefore, you're, you know, this is like a, you're moving to the right, not towards maybe more of like a center. And then the people on the right go, oh, you're still on the left. You didn't come all the way over here where I'm at. And it's just like, well, it's just, I don't know. I find it annoying because I get it on both sides constantly. It's just like, oh, you're enabling degeneracy or you're a bigot. It's like, guys, make up your mind. Okay.
I can't be both of these things. I cannot be both a alt-right entryist and a degenerate cuck. Like it's one or the other. Like there has to be a, Can we come up with a compromise between I'm a degenerate cuck and I'm an alt-right entryist? No, I think that, and now I will say this. I have seen, not from party affiliates or anything like that, but from some individuals on the, we'll start with the Mises side because it's been on both sides, but on the Mises side who will veer past just, I don't agree with that, and actually like saying like harmful things towards particularly like gay people, gender and sexual minorities and so forth, some racial stuff, but more so it's really more the LGBT stuff, right? Like making memes, making fun of trans people killing themselves and stuff like that. That's unacceptable. And when I say unacceptable, I don't want to associate with that. It's not, it should be illegal. It's, I don't want to be around that. And I don't want any leadership in the party having anything to do with that. In the same token, I have seen times when people have made similar comments about someone like you, who is a, you know, more conservative religious person, more traditional and doesn't believe in these things. And these are like to dehumanize someone and to say terrible things about them because they're living their life.
Bigotry is.
It kind of is bigotry. It's kind of the exact textbook definition of bigotry, yeah. Which is an intolerance of the opinions of others, right? Or the intolerance of different ideas or something like that, right? So that's bad, and we shouldn't have that anywhere near, you know, the party leadership or towards the messaging within the party. It's not, it should be illegal. That's not the foot we should be putting forward, and we should be when I see that, I distance myself from people like that because I don't want to be personally associated with them. Again, free association. But I think outside of that, I think that there are going to be people in the movement that think that, you know, Christianity and Islam and Judaism and religion in general is just a bunch of hocus pocus superstition. And there are going to be people who think that, you know, that is that we should be living by the word of God, whatever, you know, whether it's the Bible, the Tanakh, Bhagavad Gita or the Quran or whatever else. And that's how they think. We need to have some truces here. Like, as long as the things that are that thin line,
Spike,
and thin
if we take control of the state and try to conquer the culture, it'll work this time.
Yes, absolutely. The government, when our culture, whatever that is, takes over government, it will suddenly work and not totally backfire.
We don't have thousands of years of history to prove that this doesn't work.
We don't have the entirety of pretty much the post Babylonian Empire, like from there moving forward, showing us that government is a uniquely bad way to organize people, right? But as long as I think the one thing that we need to stick to is I don't want to force my opinion on you. As long as you're not hurting anyone else, as long as you're not harming anyone else, whether I love what you're doing and want to join you in it, or whether I think it's absolutely terrible and don't want to even be within smelling distance of it, then I don't, which can be pretty far with some things, but whatever it is, as long as we don't want to, the way we're going to build the kind of big tent movement we need is to allow for people that have differences of opinions on how people should live. And as long as no one wants to hurt each other and wants to impose themselves on each other, that's what liberty is going to look like. That's what a civil society is going to look like. A bunch of people who disagree and have their own little in-groups and their own little, you know, associations that they have and disassociations that they have, but aren't hurting each other. That's what we want. That's literally what we want.
What's your opinion? I mean, I think this works for like 99% of situations. Like sure. There's two issues where this becomes harder to preach because it's like you get into the weeds and the nuance. And I'm curious what your thoughts are. I mean, something you've probably seen if you've looked at Twitter at all over the past couple of weeks is some people from the more, you know, conservative side kind of going after some of the more libertine types because they think that there is a push, and I think this does exist. I'm still trying to sort out to what extent it exists, but that there's a concerted effort to push sort of like transgenderism or like, you know, drag queen story time or stuffing dollar bills down people's, you know.
Yeah, no, that was my line. Let me go ahead and stop. Keep asking the question, but that was my line. Like, it's not going to lick itself. And kids at what is, I believe, either a nightclub or a strip club at night with all the stuff still up, stuffing dollar bills into people. Yeah, no, that was my line. If the line hadn't been crossed before that, that was certainly my line. But anyway.
Yeah, because I agree that there's as much as I share the criticism of a lot of that movement with my fellow conservatives, my libertarian sympathies always kind of viewed this as like this is a tension between parental rights and like where do you draw that line, like, you know, should we use the government to interfere with what parents do? And I'm like, you got to be really careful with that. Because
we're both anarchists, right? We know that government is a bad way of doing stuff. So like, even if I'll say, okay, listen, this is my line and this needs to be stopped, we know that getting government involved can make it way, way worse. Yes. It can potentially backfire and make it worse. It's why I consider myself, and this isn't, I want to get back to your thing, but an example of that is abortion. I'm with Harry yeah. Brown when it comes to abortion. I hate abortion, which is why I don't want to ban on it, because I think a war on abortion is going to be just like the war on drugs and the war on poverty.
That was the other issue. I was like, this issue, like the trans stuff and like the abortion issue are the two issues where like it's the hardest to kind of have that like live and yeah. let live thing. Well,
let's get back to abortion in a second, but I want to address yeah. this, because the shorter answer is, I'm not 100% sure where the line is, man. I'm glad yeah. that I don't have kids right now, because I would, or at least I shouldn't say that. I'm glad that I don't have to deal with this, because I do think that, you know, I've seen the ones that people get upset about where it's just like someone who's dressed up in drag at a library reading a kid's book. That doesn't really bother me. I'm not sure I'd have my kid go to it, but I the people that are like, oh, that's grooming or whatever, they're dressed as a woman. They're not like doing sexual stuff. It wouldn't be, from a sexual standpoint, any different than a woman dressed as a woman doing it. It's just, it's an odd thing. I could see myself saying, I don't want my kid around that. But I can also see people going, yeah, I do want my kid around that. That thing with the nightclub and the dollar bill stuffing and yeah. the stuff that I've been seeing where like at middle schools, there are people showing up and doing essentially strip teases, but they keep some of the clothing on, like, that's not cool at all. And I would not want, if I had a kid in that school, I'd pull them out of it. That's it. And if it was a non-trans woman, you know, dressed
right. Yeah. The yeah, issue like, is less.
It's not,
yeah. The issue
it's
is not less
the
LGBT about
the
trans,
part.
Yeah.
It's the adults being sexual part and the right. Hey, kids, give them a dollar. Like, that's not cool. That isn't cool. Now the question becomes, at what involvement do I want government? And I think, instead of getting into the what government should or shouldn't be enforcing, I think we can take an even further step back and say, this is what government being in charge of education looks like right. in the first damn place. What parents said they wanted this?
Yeah, that's...
Even the ones that are okay with it. Who was waking up and going, you know what, the thing that I'm really worried about, Jacob, it's not inflation. It's not about whether my kid can get into a good school and be able to have a good job. My kid is not being exposed enough to kind of mildly sexual drag queen content at school. And that's not, something's got to give there, Jacob. Like, no one wanted this. This was government busybodies who are checking off a diversity, equity, and inclusion thing. And some group is like, hey, we got an idea. And they go, yeah, all right, that's a less for us to have to do. This is what government looks like. And so I think the better answer to, like, specifically this type of stuff is, keep government the hell out of it. Government shouldn't be involved in schooling. And this is a textbook example of why. Same thing with this, like, the trans kids debate. Do I know what is or is not a good idea for gender affirming care for a young person who identifies as trans? I have no clue. I have no clue at what age level. I'm pretty sure that I can tell you, I don't think actual body modifications is a good thing before you're an adult. I'm increasingly doubting that getting hormones involved, which are not fully reversible, like they say, is a good way of dealing with it. But I honestly, I you know, gender affirming care, like acknowledging that what they say is true, I don't know. But I do know that government will screw it up. Yeah. I know that we've got some governments that are mandating that your kids get this if they even, you know, say to anyone that they think they're trans, and then the parents not even being allowed to know because they might be bigots. You never know. And then on the other side, you've got threats of, in like Texas, where they're calling the police and CPS or whatever they call it in Texas, child protection, on parents of teenagers who have, you know, are openly trans and aren't even having surgeries or anything else. So I don't, government is just, and what they're doing in both cases, if you'll spot the pattern, in both cases, either for the more traditional side or the more libertine side, they're both arguing that the parent is doing something bad, and so the government should be in charge of it. And I got news for you. That's going to end poorly for everyone. So I yeah. don't want government involved. And I think if we take a greater step back, we're looking at the fact that government involvement is what led to all these stupid debates in the first place.
Yeah. And really, like, when you just go back to what government is, which is just, you know, men with guns compelling people to do things. It's like, these are really awful situations to try to come up with solutions for. But it's like, I don't know how just throwing, in the same way, it's kind of like when people go like, oh, this, you know, public education is failing, let's throw more money at it. Like that doesn't really solve the root of the problem. In the same way, just throwing a bunch of men with guns into the situation to say like, no,
it's definitely going to fix the trans kids debate. Yeah, exactly.
Right. Exactly. So it's a very tough issue for me, because I definitely, you know, and again, it's like, I'm always careful to try to, like, you know, because sometimes things are exaggerated, some things are taken out of context, and you know, overreported, and I never want to, like, you know, it's really easy to follow.
Oh, you don't
want to
feed
that,
into,
like,
the frenzy, right?
Yeah, I don't want to be a reactionary, which is, you know, which is a danger that I see a lot of other conservatives fall into, and I try to avoid. Not always perfectly, but I do my best. But at the same time, it's like, yeah, I do think, I do feel like, I mean, you know, for me, what I would do is, like, yeah, pull my kids out of that school and homeschool them. I mean, heck, my kids are already homeschooled. I'm not even putting them in there in the first place.
Exactly.
For the people, like, so, like, the only argument that I see some people make is, well, not everyone is going to do that all at once, or even think that as an option. And is there room for, like, you know, triage, in a sense, like in the battle right now, until we get to the point where the government's out of this, should we at least tell public schools that, like, okay, you can't do, you know, X, Y, and Z that we can, able to agree are really, really bad. And I'm like, yeah, like, that sounds reasonable.
It sounds good.
Like, the devil's in the details. Like, you know, you got to approach that. Like, at the very least, if you're going to do that, I would say approach that from your local level government.
Exactly.
It's probably a lot better than trying to approach it from Washington, or even approach it from your state level government.
So Rothbard talked about this. Rothbard talked about this, and I'm sure other anarchist theorists have talked about it ad nauseum, which is sort of the idea of the closest approximation, right? Like, if we're not going to be able to press the Rothbard button to make government go away, and we are stuck with a state in the meantime, how do we, if possible, try to get the closest approximation from the state of what would have happened absent the state? Well, that's a slippery slope if there ever was one, obviously. But I think the answer to that in this case is, maybe we should be letting these kinds of decisions, which are largely cultural decisions, be decided as locally as possible. Because now, if who knows, man, maybe we find out, and I'm just saying hypothetically, what if we find out that our concerns, and again, this is hypothetical, we find out that our concerns about some of the stuff that's going on with trans kids was completely unfounded. It was the best way to handle it, and we should have been accepting it all along. Why don't we try that as a test bed in local areas and see if it works? Instead of, if it turns out that it's an absolute nightmare and a terrible thing that leads to generational harm of children, then that was happening locally. It wasn't a one-size-fits-all program. The other part of that is, it's also more responsive. You are far more likely to get your school board to change course, even if it means replacing every last one of the school board members, than you are to get something changed at the state level once mission creep has set in, once there's an entire cottage industry of rent-seeking lobbyists built around it, much less at the federal level, where it's basically permanent and becomes a part of our society that we're told we could have never lived without before it was implemented a year ago. So I think we need to just be on any of this stuff as local and as granular as possible.
The ironic thing too, is that a lot of the more right-leaning libertarians, and I consider myself somewhat right-leaning, although I'm not, like, purely, like, you know, it's, I hate putting things in boxes like that. Because temperamentally, I'm actually more left-leaning, so it's kind of weird. Psychologically, I have all the traits that you would expect, of which makes sense, because I started out as a registered Democrat,
as a Bernie bro. Yeah,
Bernie bro. So, but so a lot of the right-leaning libertarians will talk all the time about high time preference versus low time preference behaviors, and I'm just like, okay, I was like, let's talk about high time preference behaviors then. Like, if we lived in Ancapistan. And your solution to any imperfection in society is, let's band together, travel, you know, miles away, and enforce our set of rules upon people. I was like, not only are you that's not in Capistan anymore. Now you're it's essentially becoming a state.
But, yes.
But with a high time preference, because instead of trying to, we cut out for a little bit there?
I lost you for a second, but you're back.
Yeah. But yeah, instead of trying to like solve the problem in ways that will actually solve it, you're like, no, we don't have time to try to solve this in a, you know, well-reasoned, well-thought-out way.
Yeah, it's just like,
you know, brute force, just rain men with guns down on the problem and stop. Like that doesn't work. Like, and I think the problem is like a lot of people, and this happens all over the place, not just on the right, I think it's this sort of like Nirvanian fallacy where people are just like, and it's like, but like, then you're showing to me that your understanding of libertarianism is shallow, because it's not utopianism. Like, no one's saying that we eliminate the state and all the problems in the world went away and we don't have complicated issues like this trans kid debate or abortion debate that we still have to kind of think about and solve in our individual communities and as a society. No,
as a holistic issue. Yeah.
These are still going to be like contentious issues, but all the anarchist and the libertarian is saying is trying to use the state to solve these problems is a bad idea. We're not going to have utopia, and we have to learn to try to, you know, like, even if you're convinced that you have the correct answer, it's like, well, then you need to, through the market, through social cooperation, through, you know, effective messaging and advocating that for what you, you know, for what the truth is, push that into society, and that actually solves the problem in a meaningful, more long lasting way than if you just try to, you know, correct the problem through fiat.
Well, that's the reality of high time preference decisions, right? Is that in the desire to have this quick or perfect thing, you end up making things worse very often and making the problem last longer, which feeds into your preference to get it fixed immediately. And so we end up going from crisis to crisis, like we have right now, right? And I'm glad that you've made that connection, that it is it's high time preference. And it's also this really weird, almost childish utopianism. Like, whenever I start talking about guns, inevitably someone will show up and say, but what are you going to do to make sure that no shootings happen? And I'm like, you mean ever?
Right. Yeah.
How am I going to make sure that no one ever shoots anyone? And let's go even further, because shooting is just a good thing, police never shoot people,
first of all.
No, well, of course not. But, I mean, let's go past shooting, because shooting's only one way to kill someone, right? You're asking me, how do I stop murder from ever happening?
Right.
And then being shocked that I don't give you a satisfactory, here's how I'm going to stop all murders. That's how used to the pandering of politicians people are.
Yeah.
Think of the cognitive dissonance of realizing, everyone realizes there's no such thing as utopia, right? Like, anyone who's having these conversations realizes you're never going to make murder go away. But yet they will get angry if you don't pretend along with them that there's some utopian strategy to all of this. If you actually say, listen, murders are going to happen. You know, rape is going to happen. Assault's going to happen. Theft is going to happen. We're trying to figure out a way to reduce it as much as possible and empower people to protect themselves from it as much as possible, and to remove the systemic harm of systemic murder and systemic theft and systemic sexual abuse, like the TSA and things like that. Like, we're trying to talk about how that is how to do that. And they're upset that we're not playing into the,
you know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Looks like you need a vacation. Enter the 5-Hour Energy Where Will the Tide Take You sweepstakes. You could win a $10,000 dream beach vacation. Imagine jet setting off to a tropical paradise. having fun in the sun, or diving at a gorgeous reef. It's up to you. No purchase necessary. Go to 5hetide.com for official rules and to enter. That's 5hetide.com. Enter today. Ends June 30th, 2024.
This like pandering political, well, yes, we're going to fix all of this for good. You'll never have to worry about the cost of anything ever again. And it's childish. It is. We're not participating in their childish fantasy.
Well, someone's comment here was we don't want to eliminate the state, just a million HOAs. It's like, okay, let's say that's the sort of like that weird in between anarchy and monarchy society that we move towards. Well, it's no longer an HOA if that HOA then like forms a militia and starts invading and conquering other
right.
HOAs to impose their rules.
Yeah, like a micro-state. Yeah.
Like if you're going to have like rules within a private community, go ahead and do that. I personally don't have a problem with that, but they stay within your private community and they have to be enforced, you know, ideally through contract and private property rights, not through the initiation of force.
So it's the problem with HOAs. It's a huge difference. It's also the difference between what an HOA or free association would look like in a stateless society and what it looks like now. Let's be clear. The problem with an HOA isn't that they have standards. It's that they will often get petty dictators who work with the state to enforce their petty Keystone Cop dictation on you. That's the problem. Again, it goes back to the government and the state. If there wasn't that power of, like you said, men with guns willing to show up and enforce this stuff, now they're just your schmuck neighbor telling you, you know, it says that you can't do this, but really it means you also can't do this. And you go, no, it doesn't. It means this, and I'm not going to listen to you. It's that they can get the police involved. They can get you hemmed up in the courts. That's what causes the problem, right? So again, if we're going into, you know, what stateless societies would look like, your HOA would be a voluntary free association group. Would there be some need for enforcement of things? Yeah, there would, but it wouldn't be the state. And it would be beholden and accountable to the stakeholders in that community, which is not what policing is. That is not what law enforcement is. So a perfect example of this, I have where I live, I've owned homes in like much more strict HOAs. Never do that again. The home I live in right now, we have, it's an HOA on paper, but there's no monthly dues. Every couple of years, they'll send a letter around and say, hey, we're going to, you know, clean up the signs at the front entrances. And, you know, we've got someone that's doing, we'll usually have someone that volunteers to, you know, keep the front landscaping look good and stuff like that. And every once in a while, they'll ask for a donation. And if everyone gives like $20 or whatever, it pays for the cost of it. And they raise that easily because when $20, who cares? Some people give more. We don't have a common amenities, so there's not ongoing fees or anything like that. There's a master deed, but it's very, very basic. Like it is not, it's pretty much what the county zoning is. We don't really have a lot of additional restrictions on it. And everyone gets along. And every once in a while, some busybody will come around and go, we need to ban Airbnbs. And we'll say, no, we're good. We haven't had any problems. That's some fear you have. If we have a problem, we'll deal with it. But that's your thing. And so it doesn't happen. Someone else comes along and goes, from now on, all the homes need to be at least 3,000 heated square feet. And we go, well, no, that's, our homes aren't that big. And if we had a fire, we'd have to spend extra money to make it. We're not doing that. And so like every once in a while, some busybody will come along and try to rile everyone up. And we'll be like, no, we like it here. It's good. And the power, it's not that the people in this community, some of them aren't also busybodies when it comes to like government and what they think government should do. It's that we have a good status quo here. We like it here. We like how it's working. So when someone shows up and goes, you know what, the problem is blah, 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 we're all like, or most of us are like, there is no problem. This is something you don't like, so you don't do it. And that's worked out very well. Now imagine if there wasn't even a state with the threat of possibly looming over us of enforcing that. I think that would be a great way to run a little mini micro society.
Yeah, 100% agree. So way back when I initially invited you on the show, which was way before Reno, it was because of I wanted to get a little bit into the abortion stuff again, because of the leak about the decision that's upcoming on Roe versus Wade, which we got into this a little bit the last time you were on, but you know, I think this is an issue again, kind of like the other one, where I think people on both sides kind of get it wrong. Because they, I'm curious for your thoughts to connect it back to Reno too, on the deletion of the abortion plank. Because as much as the proposed deletion and then change of the bigotry plank, I think there's a lot of nuance and you know, maybe like good faith positions on both sides. I think
there was no compromise to be made on abortion. It was
I think that was like 100% the right move. And because I think that now, you know, I was on a podcast last week and they were debating this and they were saying like, oh, well, the plank before was effectively neutral. I was like, there was a lot of people that paid lip service to the idea that, like, well, this is a hard issue and there's good faith arguments on both sides. But and then like regurgitate the idea that like effectively like a pro-choice involved, argument, the government shouldn't be involved. Yeah, and I was like, that's just like that's so now, to be fair, in a sense, I sort of agree with that statement, but it gets the problem is everybody is going to how do you define government? What do you mean by be involved? Like, it's such a nuanced thing that, like,
yes,
I think it is better to have that be removed. But
let's talk on that first. So here's my take. I was not in favor of removing it, and not because I thought it was neutral. I thought that it was. It definitely wasn't neutral because it says government shouldn't be involved. Well, that's essentially the, I guess, pro-choice argument. Like I said, I don't consider myself pro-choice because I think we need to be doing so much more focus on how to reduce abortions. I am not, you know, safe, rare, and legal. I am not celebrate your abortion. This is a terrible societal problem that we need to deal with in voluntary societal ways and in looking at how government is making it worse. I consider myself a pro-choice person that is sick and tired of people wanting to create a war on abortion that would inevitably make the problem worse and lead to more abortions. So the reason that I was in favor of the wording and keeping the wording there is I don't want government to be involved. I think they will make it worse. And here's my thought on that. So in order for this to stand up long-term, like legally in court, they're going to have to say essentially that prior to being born, that you have 14th Amendment equal protections under the Constitution. That's going, using our system of government imposed on us through the constitutional system, that's going to have to be the argument they make. And which means at some point they're going to have to say sometime between conception and birth, probably just conception, but maybe they'll pick some arbitrary time in between then, third trimester, with brain activity, heart activity, whatever. They'll have to pick some point prior to birth at which that is now a person, a recognized human being that has all of the same equal protections as you or I would have. Here's what that leads to. My mother had to have, I believe, 7 pregnancies before she was able to have me. I was either the 7th one or she had 7 ones.
Right. Every miscarriage is a criminal investigation.
Not only is it a criminal investigation, Jacob, at some point they're going to say, listen, you keep creating constitutionally protected people knowing full well that they're probably going to die. That's not happening anymore.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And the only way they're going to be able to enforce that is through licensing. And you know what happens with licensing? You have regulations, the cost of everything related to it goes through the roof. You build a rent-seeking cottage industry around it. You build a black market where people continue to get abortions because the demand didn't go away. And you end up in a situation where having and you can already hear it now, I know it. You can already hear people go, listen, if you want to have a pregnancy, you need to go through the legal process. It's not safe for a kid not to have an illegal like you can already hear it, right? That's what's going to happen. And it'll be inside of one generation that people will talk about the anarchy that was when you could have a child without having to get permission from the government and register regularly about it.
How can we have civilized society if people have kids willy-nilly?
Just having kids willy-nilly and the government doesn't even know if you're taking your government mandated prenatal vitamins? You know that's what's going to happen. And here's what's also going to happen. You're going to have a bunch of poor, usually single mothers who get pregnant accidentally and they have an illegal abortion because that's easier and cheaper to hide than an illegal pregnancy. And so it's going, and those were people that would have otherwise had the child.
it's going to make the problem worse. And I get people that will, you know, because I compare it to the war on drugs and the war on poverty. And people will say, that's different. Abortion is not the same as drugs because it's imposing on another life and all that. I understand that. I'm not arguing from a moral standpoint. I also hate abortion. I'm saying you're going to make it worse.
It suffers from the same... The instrument is just as ineffective at stopping the one thing as it is stopping the other, is the main argument.
Terrorism
yeah.
is bad, right? It's
right,
not
yeah.
terrorism is a bad thing. Blowing up buildings and hijacking airplanes and massacring
20 more years to end the war on terror.
Terrorism's bad. We're not arguing that these wars are always on things that are good or that the government shouldn't be involved in. We're just saying they suck at it. Poverty is bad. These things are bad. Right? Drug dealers, cartel gangs, they're all bad. Having a war on it creates an environment that maximizes a black market that is for the worst people in our society to become billionaires off of, simultaneously criminalizing otherwise peaceful human action. And if you want to argue that abortion is not peaceful human action, fine. It's not peaceful human action. But you are criminalizing something. And what you're also doing is ensuring that there's going to be more of it by driving up the regulatory burden and the cost of doing it the right way, and instead leading people to do it the illegal way, which is abortion. It's going to make it worse. That is my take on it. I understand why it was removed. It is truly the more neutral thing to do, to just not have it there and to let individual people do it. I don't think we should be neutral on it. I think that even pro-life people should be acknowledging that government sucks and that we should not be advocating for or missing an opportunity not to advocate for government getting involved in something that we know they're going to make worse.
So like, part of me agrees with you. And then part of me thinks like there's nuance, I think, to be found, A, because the Libertarian Party is not just the anarchist party. We have minarchists, we have constitutionalists, federalists, you know, and, you know, I would, so it's like I have to make arguments that I don't believe in, right? It's kind of like, so listen, I don't
well, to be
think
fair,
you can,
I mean,
yeah, it's like yeah. I don't think that it's possible, or I think at the very least, I think it's highly improbable that you can pass laws that have enforcement mechanisms that aren't ultimately going to be tyrannical. Now, if you do it at the local level, I guess it's a little bit better. And so some anarchists will be like, oh, well, what if states ban it? Or what if counties ban it? What if the ways in which you ban it are less punitive or like, you know, criminal, and more about like you're putting restrictions around the providers and you're putting, you know, or even like some, so like my good friend Carrie Baldwin, who is a kind of prominent pro-life libertarian, she did a debate with Walter Block at the Soho Forum on the topic of abortion, and she kind of like kind of, you know, agrees with like you and me that like, yeah, like a war on abortion would be terrible, and at the same time it's like there are different models of justice that are being experimented with in different areas at the local level. Like in some places in Colorado, they're using like a restorative justice model. And she's like, well, I guess at the local level, if you had some kind of like, you know, laws banning abortion, but they were, you know, not done with the police state we current have. So it's kind of like, okay, well, yeah, if you can imagine a minarchy that wasn't a police state and had different enforcement models, like, I guess, but, you know, my I can't help but flex anarchist and go, like, that's a lot of...
It's, that, right?
It's
like, it's what, that's
it's
the
a
problem.
A lot of what-ifs. At the same time, the only thing I'll say is, I don't want to impose my anarchist sympathies on the entire party. So it was like, the abortion issue is so complicated, but I think... That's why I kind of favored the removal. I wouldn't want a pro-life plank being put in it because I think that would be problematic.
Just being neutral. I get
Just being, I think we actually have true neutrality to say, like, listen, everyone, like you and I can make our arguments. If somebody wants to make an argument in favor of some kind of enforcement against abortion, like, we can do that, and people are more free to not join the party and feel like they're, you know, being forced to take on a position that they might not necessarily agree on. So it's definitely nuanced, the issue itself, but the plank removal, I think, was mostly good.
It's extremely nuanced. It is not as cut and dry. I think it's cut and dry that government sucks at everything they do, and so we shouldn't be advocating for it. I do think there is a minarchist slash classical liberal argument to make towards saying government shouldn't be involved. But regardless, there's also obviously a minarchist slash classical liberal argument to make. And I know the argument. The argument is that if government is to exist, it is to protect the lives and rights of all people in it. And if I am someone who believes that personhood begins before birth, then that clearly means that government should be doing something about that, whatever that is. And yes, it doesn't need to be necessarily
it's a something that you, the devil's something in the details. That What's doing? That something going to be? Because it's usually
something usually ends up becoming like the worst nightmare, right? But my concern is the nature of abortion and how to regulate it. Roe v. Wade was in retrospect going to be overturned because it was decided poorly. It was decided as like this like privacy rights thing. Well, if we're arguing that there's another human being involved, then it ain't a privacy right, right? So, but it's going to get challenged and it's going to make its way back to the Supreme Court at some point, and they're going to have to make a hard decision. It's going to come down to, does the 14th Amendment apply here? Are these constitutionally equally protected people? And if so, when? If it's at conception, I know a bunch of people who are they used to call them test tube babies. You're not supposed to call them that anymore. In vitro babies, right? They were born through in vitro fertilization. Well, the reality is the vast majority of embryos are discarded during in vitro fertilization. So that'll be illegal, right? So now you're actually anti-life. You're not creating human lives because a bunch of embryos are going to get destroyed in the process. It's a very difficult thing, man. And I'm like you. I'm an anarchist. So I keep going back to the government sucks at everything they do model. But I do think even from a government should be doing some things model, which is hard for me to grok because I don't believe that. But even from that model, I think there's still an argument to make that because of the nature, it is different saying we're going to enforce a law saying that you, Jacob, can't kill me, Spike, and vice versa. It becomes a lot more sticky and difficult to be able to try to enforce if one of us is inside gestating of the other one, right? Like it's different and we all know it. And so it's just the, like you said, devil is in the details. It was not a deal breaker for me. I tried to see if there was some wiggle room. There wasn't. You either think government should be involved or you shouldn't. And really, honestly, the compromise between that is we just don't answer. So I understand why they did it. It's not a deal breaker. I haven't left the party. I wish it had stayed in because I do think we should be making the argument that government sucks at stuff and that this is a perfect example of how government could make things. I look forward to being on conservative shows and then bringing up abortion and me talking about how just like prohibition of alcohol blew up in everyone's faces, so would a war in the war on poverty, so would a war on abortion. Like I look forward to talking to people who hate abortion as much as me about it.
It's also the opportunity cost, like how much money and energy is going to go towards trying to just through fiat stop it all versus like what if we put that same amount of money and effort towards like parents. Helping women because I think most women don't want to get an abortion. They either get pressured into doing it for economic reasons or their family's pressuring them, the partner's pressuring them. You know, it's a vast minority.
And they know that if they have the child, that child gets put in the foster care system.
Yeah,
which is
and our abortion laws are incredibly ridiculous. It's like you can't just go to. It's very hard to just go to someone, and even if you knew someone in your community that wanted a baby, the state's so involved, you can't just go, "Hey, I want to get my baby to them." It's like, oh, well, we got to get our fingers in here first, and you know, do all these. It's crazy.
If we focused our political activism on making common sense reforms on adoption and the foster system. And possibly even getting government out of foster care, but at the very least, getting rid of some of these absurd. It costs tens of thousands of dollars to legally apply for an adoption. It's stupid.
Crazy. Yeah.
Fighting that and looking at the economic reasons. The vast majority of times that women get abortions, it is for economic reasons. And we need to look at things like getting rid of occupational licensing laws, getting rid of overly burdensome taxes that always and end up hurting the poorest among us. Getting rid of the war on poverty. Less inflationary spending policies, eventually getting rid of the Federal Reserve, things that actually drive down the cost of living and drive up economic opportunities, liberating, we call it liberalizing or libertarianizing the economy, so that more women can afford another child. Because a good, I think something like half of the women who get abortions are parents. These aren't baby murderers. These are parents. They just can't afford another kid, and they don't want the kid to be put in the foster care system. And in that moment, with this child that isn't even possibly thinking or breathing yet, they think, you know what? Best thing is probably just to abort it. And I hate that, but I understand why they do it. And I think if we looked at alleviating the issues that lead to abortion, that would be so much of a better use of our time than trying to figure out how we can create a new black market for you know, criminals.
Yeah, I mean, at the end of the day, it's the woman, the mother is the one with the most power to protect that baby's life. Exactly. And the one who kind of makes that final decision, like all the laws in the world, like she can still, through the black market, end up, you know, in front of the mirror holding those pills in her hand. And she's the one that has that power to decide. It's like, you know, even if we could objectively say that, oh, if she takes the abortion pills, that's morally wrong. It's like, okay, I agree. I think it's morally wrong. But like, just again, it's like, I don't know. I get tired of moral pontificating about like, if we just loudly condemn, like, this is bad. It's like, and then we put it on, you know, it is.
If you are implementing policies that, you know, at best will not solve the problem, but, and at worst will make it worse, but allows you to say, well, I have spoken out about this thing. You are literally virtue signaling. It is not helping the problem. Let's address helping the problem. With that said, I understand why they removed it. It's not, we are not now a pro-life party or a pro-war on abortion party. We're just letting individual candidates, individual activists, individual members, and so forth, give their opinion on it. And I'm certainly not stopping doing that. Like I said, it wasn't a deal breaker. I wanted to keep it there because I don't think government should do anything. I want our platform to be as close to explicitly anarchist as the rest of the party can tolerate.
I hear you, but
I get it. And it was not, like I said, it was not a deal breaker. There was no way to do a compromise there. Like that kind of already was the compromise between the pro-life position and the pro-choice position. The only additional compromise there could be was just saying, you know what, we're not even going to answer that. You get to decide for yourself what your libertarian take on abortion is.
I agree. So I guess the last subject we can talk about here, I wanted to get a little bit into your, you know, personal religious views, because I haven't heard you talk about this a lot on maybe you have, I just haven't seen it. But, you know, like my show, I like to, other than talking about current events and stuff like that, you know, like, you know, obviously, like I try to, you know, connect my faith and like the Bible to, you know, libertarian ideas, anarchist ideas, show compatibility there. And even in more in general, just trying to, you know, show in general how, like, you know, people of faith, because sometimes people will look at religion and be like, you know, like, oh, you can't be an anarchist and be a, you know, Jewish or Christian or whatever, because you know, no gods, no masters. And it's like, nah, whatever. That's not a majority by
any
means.
Thick that's anarchy. We're thin. Yeah. There's thin anarchy, which is just no imposed authority that we don't accept. And then there's I guess thick anarchy, which is we don't even accept the idea of a you know, a heavenly authority or whatever.
Right. So you know, what are your personal like religious views, and you know, do you in any way connect you know, any faith or spiritual beliefs you have to your libertarian philosophy?
So the reason I often don't, and I'm happy to talk about it, but the reason I often don't talk about religious stuff is I have found that it's a great way for people to argue about something that like we have no control over. Like it's actually worse than arguing about politics, because at least arguably you could try to change something. I grew up in the Messianic Jewish tradition, or first century Christian tradition, which is basically Jews who believe in Jesus, not Jews for Jesus. There's a distinct difference here that I'm not gonna bother getting into, but Messianic Judaism. That was what I grew up in. Over time, it's interesting, because as I fell away from the belief part of it, the faith part of it, I actually got more into the tradition and the oral and spoken tradition part of it. So it's like, as I got more away from the actual faith in a at least the Abrahamic description of a higher power, I actually got closer to the actual, like the traditional part of it. Like I'm much more active now than I was when I was a believer in like Shabbat and in dietary customs and things like that. And in fact, it was actually that faith and the, I guess, remnant of that faith that informed my becoming an anarchist. Because when you look at Tanakh, when you look at when you look at the Bible, because that includes the New Testament, but especially when you look at the Old Testament, it's basically a series of stories about how God told people, just follow me, just trust me, just listen to me. I've got this. I control the entire universe. Just freaking calm down and let me handle this. And everyone's like, no, we need a king. Oh, please.
Yeah.
We need someone. Look, they got a king. They seem happy. Let's go have a king. And God's like, okay, well, listen, if you have a king, this bad thing's going to happen. And they're like, yeah, give us the king. And they're like, okay, but if it's like a Larry David thing. It's like, you know, he's just like, well, but if you do this, this is going to happen. And they're like, okay. And then it blows up in their face and they get, you know, scattered for centuries and all. Like it is a series of stories of what happens when you don't trust God and instead you just want to go off and create your own man-made law. So to me, my introduction into anarchy was really diving into that and going, huh, well, that makes sense. And, you know, maybe we shouldn't have people ruling over other people. I will say over time, you know, I kind of did a common path of people that are coming out of Abrahamic faiths where I call it the dual, and this is not an offense to people that believe, but I call it the dueling mythologies. There's the first mythology or belief, which is of the sort of paternal god who controls the world and is watching you and wants to make sure you do the right thing and you have to listen to him or there's going to be problems. And then a lot of people who kind of walk away from that fall into what I call the second mythology, which is the uncaring, mechanical, meaningless world where you are basically just this really, really weird, unfortunate fluke that, you know, not sure why you're here, but it's probably not good. And there's no real purpose. And the logical conclusion of that is if you're not having a good time, you might as well just end it because there's no reason for you to be here. Well, that over time made less and less sense. So I would say from a belief system standpoint, what I believe now or what I lean more towards probably is more in the realm of like Taoism or Zen Buddhism. If you had to pick something, with that said, I cherish and am grateful for the tradition that I came out of. And when I look at historical figures, this is almost unequivocal that when you look at historical figures, you can't find someone who more embodies, not just as libertarians or anarchists, but just as good, decent people, how someone should be to others than Jesus. Right. Like,
yeah.
There's little dispute that he wasn't an historical figure. The dispute basically comes down to, was he really the Messiah and the Son of God and the part of the Trinity and so forth. But whatever your take is on that part, here is someone who almost indisputably was one of the best examples of how a human should be to other humans ever. And obviously, if you believe he's the Son of God, well, that would make sense. He's the Son of God, right? Like, of course, God's going to be the best example of how people should be. But if you don't believe that, well, then that means here's someone who isn't immortal and still did all of that sacrificial stuff and still was there for other people. So I will say that, you know, even despite my lack of the faith in Abrahamic faith that I previously had, I still believe that the example of Jesus is, if not the best, probably the best, I would say the best, but certainly one of the best examples that anyone, whether you believe or not, can look at of how should someone look at their role as a person in this world, in this society, and in how we should interact with one another. So that's my take on that.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, one is that you brought up, you know, kind of like the Old Testament theme, kind of starting in 1 Samuel 8 with like, we want a king and, you know, all that. And I talk about that a lot. Certainly, you know, a very important theme that I think connects, you know, sort of Abrahamic, all Abrahamic religions really, because they all believe at least in that story, that connects Abrahamic religions to libertarianism and anarchy. But Jesus, you know, there's also like, there's so much there in the things he said and the things he did. One of my favorites, you know, because some people will kind of go like, well, no matter what, you're going to have authority, right? You're going to have people who rise to the top of you know, hierarchies in society, right, and they're right. going to lead people. And it's like, listen, I agree, but like,
yeah,
what is leadership? What is authority, and what is good leadership and authority? And I love the answer Jesus gave. He said, if you want to be the first among everybody, if you want to be a leader, you have to humble yourself and be a servant. And he washed his apostles' feet.
And he did it. He then did that. Yes, right. Exactly.
Yeah. And it's like, and not just like he was a really cool dude who, if you drink the Kool-Aid, he was the Son of God. He was divine. And he humbled himself to that.
He's washing prostitutes' feet and stuff like that. Like, I mean, there is someone who is like literally embodying the ultimate in humility and telling people, do this, right? Like, do this in my stead. Do this as I'm doing it. Here is how you can help people, right? I think that he's, like I said, to me, he's the best, one of the best examples of that. There was something I was going to say, and I'm blanking now. But, you know, a lot of Christians will get caught up in, is it Romans 13 that talks about, God, I saw the look on your face. It's Romans 13 that talks about...
Let me show you my
Yes, but my Romans 13. Yes, yeah. Exactly. So this is, you know, the it says to submit to authority. No, it says to submit to godly authority.
Right.
And it lays out very clearly what that godly authority is.
Exactly.
And the logical conclusion of saying, oh no, it says all authority. Well, then that means that anyone who resisted the Third Reich was a bad person.
Right.
Anyone who tried to any slaves who tried to flee their captors were bad people. In fact, Romans 13 was given as a justification for fugitive slave laws, that they weren't obeying God's law to obey their godly authority. Like,
the apostles didn't obey the authorities.
Thank you.
They got stoned by the authorities. Jesus didn't obey the authorities. The name of my podcast, Daniel 3. I mean, Meshach, Radshach, and Abednego didn't submit to the governing authorities.
Disobeyed the authorities. Yes. And so, and they'll say, well, but yes, but that's so it means the duly appointed authorities. Okay, now we're getting somewhere. Okay.
Yeah, but what does duly appointed mean? Yeah.
Look at the wording of when, and keep in mind, this was written, was it Paul that wrote it?
Yeah.
When he was captive.
Yeah.
So he was writing this out in prison, knowing the censors were going to look at it. So this guy has to be a little slick, right? Like when he's writing this. And so he's saying, listen to the authorities, listen to the godly appointed authorities,
because
they do this and they do that.
Right. They're not a terror to those who do good. They're a terror to those who do evil. And it's like, cool. And I always tell people, can you please find me? Like, this is the challenge. Find me one state that lives up to Romans 13.
Any line from
one.
This. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's what I say. I'm like, listen, you show me the government that qualifies for this, and I'll obey them.
Yeah.
But we both know that doesn't exist, right? So that is, and this is where a lot of people will get caught up on the other side of saying, well, you know, Christianity is inherently statist. And it's like, not really. You could argue that, so people will argue that Jesus was an anarchist. I think it goes deeper than that. Jesus wasn't about any man-made systems at all.
One of my kingdoms, not of this world, is what he
said. Jesus was, you know, straight up telling people, like, give all your money away and sell it, give it all to the poor, and go follow me barefoot walking around washing people's feet. Like, he was on a different level. So to try to box him in, I mean, forget the fact that he's not a Republican or a Democrat. He wasn't a libertarian. He wasn't an anarchist. He was like, just, he was on a completely different, whether you think he was the Son of God or not is irrelevant. He was on a completely different wavelength.
Yeah.
And we should not be trying to compare ourselves to him unless we want to go and do that crap. Like, if you want to go and wash everyone's feet and own nothing and like it and go around the world and remind everyone of their failings and why they need to change the way that they interact with every single human being in their life, knowing that everyone's going to hate you saying that, then you can talk about what Jesus would want. Otherwise, maybe we should just not try to pretend that Jesus fits into our paradigm of politics.
Yeah, agreed. And then there's a comment here that biblical Israel was an anarcho-covenant. And the book of Judges was essentially several hundred year period of Old Testament Israel they were just basically living. Now, and then some people go, oh, but look at what happened at the end. There was this big war that broke out and bad things happened. It's like, and then they got a king and everything was great. No more wars happened after they got a king.
Yeah, no, that was fine. Jews are, and the Jews are best known as being the most plentiful population on Earth, having a huge expansion of land that we have control over. You know, someone asked me, you know, we talk about Jews all the time, and then they looked it up and saw there were only like 30 million Jews or some ridiculous, like there's like next to no Jews compared to other and they're like, why is that? I'm like, because we get genocided every like 50 to 100 years. Like, this is the longest stretch. I just found this out starting in like the 90s. This is the longest stretch since the expulsion that Jews have experienced living as an overwhelming minority among an overwhelming majority Gentile non-Jewish population that we haven't been rounded up and killed or exiled, yeah. Which is good. We got that going for us. But the point is, yeah, you should not be looking at the Jewish empire as an example of, well, you know, but the Jews did it. Yes. How did that work for them?
I don't think they've even claimed the entire promised land. Like the when it was originally defined, like the borders of what God promised them. I don't think at any point in their history they obtained
ever
all of
had
it.
Anywhere near that. No, yeah. No. It's most of the, you know, we talk about the Levant, the Levant. It's like it goes all the way to like freaking Iraq or something. Like yeah. it's supposed to be this gigantic territory. They've never had that. So if we are applying biblical principles, that leads me. I will tell you. It was biblical principles. It was what I was taught growing up and what I was taught in Tanakh that more than anything solidified my ideas behind anarcho-capitalism and a society based on free association as opposed to an imposed manly authority. Right. So the manly authority is, or the human authority is, well, this is what we believe, and if you don't do these things, you're going to go to hell, which in the Jewish tradition isn't eternal necessarily, but it's still pretty bad punishment. Okay, so then I still get to choose, right? So yeah, it's only moving forward later on that they started saying, yeah, well, we want a king. And God's like, sure.
He literally says, yeah. like you will fight on the front lines of all of his wars, and he's going to take like, I always love, like, he said, I'll take a tenth of all of your crops and harvests. And I'm just like, gosh, can we go back to that at least? Can we just go back to when the government took a tenth of my
stuff?
Oh, it
sounds so much better, right? Yeah. Like, well, we're already fighting in their wars, but they only take a tenth of what we have. And every 50 years we get a jubilee. And then every once in a while, someone's wife gets taken if she's pretty.
Yeah.
That's
I love that. Like,
better.
The best king they had, a man after God's own heart, and like, yes, still kind of wasn't
murdered that. Someone, yeah. So he could have his wife because she was pretty. Yeah. And I like that, by the way. That's another thing that I really like about the and I don't know if this is true of other religious faiths because I'm not as well versed, but every single figure in the Bible fell short at some point. Yep. Like all of them. If they had any kind of more than just a supporting role, and even some of the supporting roles in the Bible, Old and New Testament, really did something really terrible. Like Moses, Noah, Abraham, like straight up lied that his wife was his sister to try to get, like, I mean, like all of them did something terrible, sometimes lots of terrible things. And we're still told, yeah, but they were actually good people. In other words, everyone falls short. Right. So the only person that didn't do that was Jesus. And that's the whole point of it, is that, you know, there's an underlying story there as well, which is that you can't be God unless you're God. You're not going to be perfect unless you're God, which means that maybe you should, as Jesus put it, deal with your own stuff instead of, you know, dealing with the mote in someone else's eye. All of this goes back to libertarian ideas. I'm not saying Jesus is a libertarian, but it goes back to the idea of mind your own business. Do not hurt other people. Do not take their stuff. Let people live their own lives as long as they're not hurting you. If you want to live in association with others that follows your very strict values, and great, do that. But let other people live their lives as they see fit. Stop trying to create a central authority. It's to make everything worse.
Well, and it especially irritates me when, you know, Christians and, you know, especially Christian, I guess Christian progressives in a different way do this too. But it's like, you know, Jesus said to go out there to preach the gospel and to, you know, what you've done to the least of these, you've done unto me, to serve the widow, the orphan, the downtrodden. And I'm just like, cool. I was like, please show me where in what Jesus modeled and what he taught that I'm supposed to go centralize power and point guns at people to compel them. Like, no, that's, if anything, the reason why the Jews, at least like, you know, at that time sort of rejected Jesus was because they were looking for a political Messiah to overthrow Rome and to usher in a new kingdom of man. And Jesus said, like, no, like, you know, I told you, you know, hundreds of years ago that wasn't going to work. It still doesn't work. We're not doing that. Like, you know, we got to get out of, you know, if anything, even if you don't believe in the metaphysical or spiritual truth of the Bible, it's a great story, I think. Among all the different lessons in there, there's a great lesson about the myth of central planning. Like, it just doesn't work. So it's like God's the most sovereign of all, and he can't even get, like, he rescues the Israelites out of Egypt, and he's just like, hey, just hang out on this the bottom of this mountain and don't do anything stupid while Moses goes up to the top of the mountain. And like, they just
immediately
and after, like, you know, if you believe in the what it says, like, they literally saw acts of God deliver them from slavery and they still can't, like, so it's like you
know, 10 minutes, like, I'm gonna go up here, I'll be right back in a day or two, and they're like, let's worship a cow. Like, it's a great story of, and I like, I liked I will say of the different ideas behind, you know, different Christian thought, whatever. I like the reformist take on certain things, not all things, but on certain things, because the reformist take seems to be, you know, a lot of these, especially the feel good non-denominational churches are like, you know, they'll start comparing you to like Moses and stuff. And they're like, oh, you had haters? Well, so did Jesus. And it's like, that's not your haters. You might actually be a jerk. I don't know. But they'll like start comparing you to like the heroes of the Bible. And whereas the reformist take is, nah, you're probably like one of the unnamed people who was running around shrieking and like losing your mind and like immediately worshiping a cow the very second they weren't looking at you, right? Like statistically, you are likely to be like someone who was like, okay, cow time. Like, you know, like you know, that's probably very, maybe you're one of the rare few that's the Moses or the whatever, but it's actually likely they weren't. And there's, and the purpose behind that is, I think a lot of people get disabused into this notion that there are these powerful, good people that we're going to find and they're going to fix it all. We even do it in the liberty movement, right? We're looking for liberty, Jesus. I get told all the time, you're the one that's going to fix this. And I'm like, no. And or they'll say, or not me, they'll say Dave Smith is going to fix all it. Justin Amash is going to fix it. And I'm like, no, these are great people and I think they're going to do good things, but this is a movement. This is not going to be a single person drives us to victory, and we don't even believe that's how things work, but it's such a pervasive mythology that people have. But it's high time preference and it's utopianism. It is, yep. I just need someone to fix this. But the reality is that's not how we got here, by trying to do that. And we're not going to get out of it that way. And I think that whatever your religious background is, whatever your side you take, and, you know, we've been talking about the social stuff, whatever side you take on these things, if we can distill it down to something very basic, very intuitive that we tell kids, don't hurt people, don't take from people without their consent. And if we distill it down to that, understanding there are still going to be disagreements, understanding that everyone's not going to live this way, there are going to be people that try to infringe on others and we need to be able to protect ourselves from them, understanding that this is not going to be a utopia. But if we try to get as close towards that ideal as possible, that I think that we live in a better society, a safer society, a freer society, a better educated society, a healthier society, every way that you could measure the health or well-being of a society will do better. If we focus on that as libertarians, I think that all we can do is go up from there. But it starts with, and this is why I started You Are the Power, we need to realize that no one's coming to save us. Mm-hmm. And that's okay, because we're the ones that are going to save us. We are going to be the ones that do the work on the ground to fix the problems that we
pick up
facing.
Your cross and you know what I mean,
and walk with it. Exactly.
Yeah,
literally pick up your cross and walk with it, and set your communities free. Show people how it's done. If you don't know how it's done yet, there are people in the movement that are ready to support you and show you how it's done, and then you can do it too, and you can join them in doing it. We're going to fix this. We are our heroes. And I think if we look at it that way, whatever your background is, the reality is if we look at ourselves as the heroes that we're going to need on the earthly realm, obviously, if you're a believer, there's something far bigger than any of this that, you know, it is a much more important thing than, you know, your day-to-day life or whatever. But on the earthly realm and the mortal coil of our existence, we're our heroes and we're the ones that are going to fix this. And that's what we're doing every day. If you want to find out more, you want to be a part of it, you want to, you know, join, become a part of the fastest growing Liberty movement that's out there right now, and get support from some of the biggest names in the Liberty movement and to help push it forward and, you know, set our communities free one issue at a time. Join us at youarethepower.net. We'd love to have you. Membership is free. We certainly could use, you know, any donations that you are able to give. Running a political organization does cost money, but we want members. We want people that are involved. That matters more to us than your money. So we would love to have you join us. Youarethepower.net. And Jacob, I appreciate you having me on, man.
Yeah, no, I appreciate you coming on. You know, sometimes I view you as like libertarian Jonah. You know, sometimes you're sent to Nineveh to try to, you know. Yeah.
All of you are wrong.
Yeah.
I don't even want to do this.
Yeah.
Yep, I just got spat out by fish. They wouldn't let me just go take a nap. So here I am to tell you that you're all wrong. Can I go home now, please? Yes.
But listen, I hope you know that you know you are appreciated, and we, you know, a lot of us, you know, I think that, you know, you can serve to be a voice of reason and uniter, and I hope that, you know, I know there's some people who refuse to stop fighting, but there also are a lot of people who hear your calls for everyone to, you know, take a deep breath, go touch some grass.
Stop ripping and, each other to shreds.
Yeah,
that's all I ask.
Yep. So I appreciate everything you do. Where can people, you know, you are the power. Is there a website or anything?
Yeah. The website is youarethepower.net. We are also on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, with more coming soon. And that is YATP official. They're all at YATP official, or if you just look up You Are the Power, you can find them. And our website is youarethepower.net. If you want to follow me, I'm on social media, Spike Cohen, all on all social media. I'm even on TikTok for the kids. And my website is spikecohen.com. If you want to follow the podcast that I do, that's on Muddied Waters Media, muddiedwatersmedia.com, or you can find Muddied Waters Media on all podcasting platforms, all social media platforms. And again, thanks for having me on, man. I always love talking with you.
Yep. Thanks, Spike. Thanks everybody for watching. And until next time, don't fear the fire.
When you visit Arizona, time is measured in moments, not minutes. Like the moment your work stress disappears as you kayak through the canyons. Or the moment you discover the life-changing effects of prickly pear chocolate. But nothing beats the moment you see the Grand Canyon for the very first time. Visit a new state of mind. Learn more at hereyouareaz.com.
Prescription products require completion of an online medication consultation with an independent healthcare provider through the LifeMD platform and are only available if prescribed. Subscription required. Individual results may vary. Additional restrictions apply at LifeMD.com. Read all warnings before using GLP-1s. Side effects may include a risk of thyroid C-cell tumors. Do not use GLP-1s if you or your family have a history of thyroid cancer.
If you've struggled for years to lose weight and have given up hope, did you know you can now access GLP-1 prescription medications through LifeMD? LifeMD is now offering eligible patients online access to GLP-1s, the breakthrough prescription medication that can help you lose body fat and weight. Listen to what people are saying.
You just take your shot. It doesn't feel like you're on a diet. What I wasn't expecting it to do was to shut off the food noise. This was life-altering, and if I can do it, I feel like anybody can do it.
And here's the best part. Your insurance may cover 100% of the cost of your medication. So go to TryLifeMD.com to have your eligibility checked right now. Get started today at TryLifeMD.com. That's TryLifeMD.com.